Okay, so in terms of the RBA's role, we've got a role in supervising CCPs. We also have a role in providing advice to government around specific mandates that could be in place in Australia. So I'll speak from that kind of perspective. So in Australia at the moment, in terms of CCPs that are licensed to actually provide clearing directly to participants, we've got three CCPs, ASX, CME, and LCH, all licensed to provide clearing of interest rate derivatives. We certainly haven't seen any desire for those CCPs or indeed others to seek a license around FX products yet. So the market will be looking to access clearing through those CCPs indirectly. At present. In terms of clearing mandates, we obviously have in place at the moment a clearing mandate for interest rate products for Australian dollars, British pound, US dollars, euro, and Japanese yen. What would be the process for us extending that mandate? Well, there would be an extremely large amount of consultation. So, obviously, in order to extend that mandate, the government would need to consult on any determination. The Council of Financial Regulators, ASIC, APRA, the RBA would need to consult ahead of our advice. And indeed, if there was a determination made, then ASIC, if it decided to, would need to consult around derivatives transaction rules. I guess, why am I highlighting that? Well, we're not consulting at the moment. We're not actively consulting at the moment in terms of any of those layers. And so that should give you an indication around whether we are planning to impose any additional mandates at this stage. We are, however, monitoring developments in the markets, whether it is the incentives that are arising that have been mentioned on the panel already around the imposition of margin for non-centrally cleared derivatives. We also, at the international level, there will be an OTC derivatives team report looking at the incentives of the reforms, and that's due to come out with a report at the end of 2018. So it'll be that type of information that we're looking at. Obviously, there have been delays in Australia and elsewhere around the imposition of these types of requirements. And so at this stage, we're monitoring developments.
Okay. So a lot of the this drive towards clearing, creates an issue creates additional burden for CCPs or puts CCPs really at the heart of things. So one of the things I want to talk about, and we're actually getting some questions from the audience on this, so it's probably quite a good moment to bring it in, is the extent to which thought is being given and should be given to CCP resilience. And there's a particular question for Sarah here, so we'll start from that with that, which is one I was going to put to her anyway. But what is the RBA's view on increase in concentration risk from CCPs reducing counterparty risk where we have created a bigger risk?
So I guess up front I should say that from our perspective we don't think everything should go into clearing. There is definitely a market for bespoke transactions, and obviously there are a whole set of reforms looking at how we can improve the kind of resilience and frameworks and approaches that market participants apply in that space. So just say up front that we are a CCP regulator, but that doesn't mean that we want to regulate the world or we want to push everything into clearing. In terms of the role of CCPs, they're obviously always been systemically important. They're now increasingly becoming more critical given the mandates that we are actually imposing on people to use this type of infrastructure. So we do recognise that CCPs and other types of infrastructure have to be more robust and more resilient. I'm happy to kind of elaborate on some of the work that we're doing, or we can take that later. I don't know how you want to.
Yeah. I mean, maybe you can take that point up.
Yep. So internationally, the standard setting bodies for central banks and securities regulators, CPMI and IOSCO, have recently published some additional guidance to the international standards that for financial market infrastructure. And that's recognising that we want to have increased resilience in terms of CCP's financial risk management. And in that regard, the additional guidance is not creating new standards, it's effectively constraining interpretation of the current standards. And it focuses on things like reiterating the importance of governance, and the role of boards in terms of financial risk management. Boards can't just delegate responsibility down to risk management officers in the firm. There needs to be more transparency of risk management to stakeholders and other players in the market. Very much looking at other things like stress testing in relation to credit and liquidity risks, the actual coverage of pre-funded financial resources. We talk a lot about the fact that systemically important CCPs should hold pre-funded resources to cover the default of their largest two counterparties. I think part of the additional guidance just re-emphasises that that's a minimum requirement, and we are wanting risk managers to kind of think beyond that. And also the fact that those pre-funded resources should be held on an ongoing basis rather than it being kind of resized at particular points during the cycle. There's also points in there around the types of financial resources, etc. So that particular report is very much focused on providing more detailed guidance around CCP resilience. Similarly, there's been information put out around recovery planning. So what happens for CCPs trying to do ex-ante planning around particular stressed events that may call into question their own viability. And again, there's more guidance there around how they operationalise those plans. So I'll pause there for other comments from the panel.
Okay, thanks. Let's get a view from CCP and Marcus. Every CCP is different, so should they all be treated the same when it comes to resilience?
Yeah, it's a very topical question, and I think it has been really since the regulatory reform kind of came in, and with mandatory clearing being brought in globally. So CCP resilience is something that we pay, obviously, as a CCP, very close attention to. And we're talking about not just the bottom of the waterfall with the recovery planning, but throughout the whole waterfall. So it's starting at the top for making sure that all of our the way that we calculate our margin, that we're incorporating all of the risks of the products that we're clearing, going through into the default fund in terms of how it's structured, how it's calculated, making sure that obviously we're avoiding ever getting to that recovery situation at all. So, but one of the key things that we've been really focused on and really trying to push is around kind of how do you measure CCP resilience? So, what are we talking about resilience? Resilience is really how a CCP reacts in stress market conditions. So how does it react? Has it got sufficient resources to be able to sustain the default of its largest two clearing members, for example? And one of the big challenges is how do you, as the participants, the members, the clients, and even the regulators, compare the resilience of CCPs against each other? So CCPs globally, they are one regulated predominantly by in different regulations, different jurisdictions. they're clearing different asset classes. They have different structures in terms of how their waterfalls are constructed. So it makes it very hard for regulators and the market really to compare how these CCPs are, how to compare the resiliency of each CCP. And so we've been pushing quite hard, and there's a white paper that we've written on this, which is really trying to promote kind of a standardised stress test framework that kind of tries to consider and looks at many components of that. So how the default funds are segregated. Are they segregated per asset class, or are they commingling asset classes together? How the stress scenarios are determined, and that can obviously vary dependent on the type of asset class that you are clearing, but I think having some standardised form of stress testing is quite important. And then I think more importantly, which is the important part, is then how those results are reported. So how are you aggregating that data together, and so that it can be interpreted on a single and standalone basis, I think is quite important. So I think the resiliency piece, yes, it's very important, but I think given the broad nature of CCPs, and generally most of the market will access more than one CCP, understanding how resilient these CCPs to these certain stresses, I think, is quite important. But I think the number one issue we have is the aggregating of the data and the reporting of that in a consistent format.
Okay, sorry, but I just wanted to tease out something which I don't think is talked about enough, which is there's a difference between resilience of the CCP and resilience in market trade. To be more precise about that, the job of an LCH or any other CCP is to ensure that the participants are kept whole, or risk is mutualised, or that default are paid where possible. That's very different if the skies are particularly dark and there are defaults. The probability of trade continuing in a situation where a major clearing broker, a member of LCH, for example, has defaulted is such that your capability of placing a trade through there might be slightly impaired. Beforehand, we're talking about how to get products on. Well, they need to be risk manageable, and there needs to be appropriate liquidity and whatnot. If you're in a situation where we start questioning, or do we need to wonder whether is my CCP or CCPs resilient in this situation, if you're actually facing that in real time, the odds are that the market that is being traded is probably seized up to a fair extent. So I just think that's something that needs to be a clear differentiation, like the survivorship of a CCP or its members is different to the survivorship of functioning markets.
Okay, and Stuart, your thoughts on CCP?
Sure. I mean, it's really comforting. So obviously, as a member, we don't have full insight into any clearinghouse, let alone the LCH. So it's it's really important that the regulators do, and they're in a much better position to sort of look at that resilience. And I'll continuously complain about the amount of initial margin that we have to post our obligation under the default fund, but ultimately it's in our vested interest to have a very, very safe clearinghouse, and that's the price you pay. So you kind of there's a cost to having eliminating that systemic risk to a degree, and it's important that the right people have kind of their eye on the ball, which as you've just said, we absolutely do.
Do you want to add something?
The other thing from a regulatory perspective that is happening is that, to speak to some of Marcus's points, is that the kind of standard setting bodies are monitoring implementation of the PFMI. So we're looking across different jurisdictions, we're looking across different FMI types. One of the kind of inputs to the new resilience guidance was work that we did across 10 derivative CCPs, looking at their financial risk management and governance. LCH, CME, ASX were all part of that study. And so it was through looking at that kind of population of CCPs, as well as gathering other information, feedback from the consultation, that we've devised these new standards. Similarly, on the recovery side, that's another area that we're very much closely monitoring individual jurisdictions' implementation, how complete that implementation is, but also you know, what outcomes is that driving in terms of the risk management of the infrastructure that are alive. Similarly, there is work on interdependencies that has just been trying to highlight the role that kind of financial participants play in the financial system. So that's been another one around trying to raise awareness around some of the issues. And then lastly, I just mentioned that there's been some further work around supervisory stress tests and trying to look at what the kind of shocks would be and what results that would drive, again, to try and understand what the interdependencies might be between CCPs. So, you know, there is a hell of a lot of work going on from a regulatory perspective to make sure that we're tracking that.
Okay, sure. And another thing I'd like to talk about is there's a lot of talk about, you know, this drive towards centralised clearing because of all the regulation that's come out. But there's a question of why not clear everything? Why doesn't everything go through the clearing houses? What are the challenges that are there in terms of clearing everything? And Marcus, maybe I could get your thoughts on that.
Sure. So I think, as has been mentioned already, I think that there is a limit of what can be cleared. So from a CCP perspective, we look very closely at the risk components of clearing a product. So we look, obviously, for liquidity. We look for how many participants are trading that product. So those components are very important to us. So exotic products, really, will they ever be subject to, or will they ever be clearable? Probably unlikely, given they are generally very bespoke. The other angle, as I mentioned before, is the economics. So looking at the economics and the cross-currency swap example is just one part of that as well. So I think that there is a limit of what products can be cleared, but I think the products that we are seeing kind of real big growth area in, I think one I mentioned before, the NDF product, that we've seen since the uncleared margin rules came in last year, the volume in NDFs has increased. And we're also see demand for clearing other FX products, such as FX options, which are also captured by the uncleared margin rules. So that's a service that we're looking to launch at the end of the year. So I think for those products that where there's the economic incentive and advantage to do that, I think we will start seeing some of those products going into clearing. But the more esoteric products, or maybe, for example, the FX spot market, where there's really very little economic incentive for clearing a product that's really only holds two-day risk to be cleared, with all of the settlement risks in there as well. I think there's a limit in terms of what can be cleared there. But where we do see we do see advantages or a role that kind of a CCP or the CCP functions can play in the uncleared margin as well. So one area that we've started exploring is really around what role we could play to try and leverage some of the infrastructure that we've built around clearing, but in this uncleared margin space. So a service called Swap Agent that we're launching, which effectively is acting as a calculation agent for all of those products that are uncleared, but trying to leverage and reuse as much of that infrastructure that effectively the market has spent millions of dollars developing to access into clearing, but access that into some form of calculation agent that can try and then bring the efficiencies around margin calculation into the uncleared space as well. So I think it creates, whilst products that can be cleared will be cleared, I think there are still some lessons that we can be learned in the in clearing that we can apply into the uncleared space as well.
Okay. If anyone else wants to maybe try to...
Yeah, I think swap agents are... Right. Yeah, swap agents are a very interesting development because when we talk about liquidity, when we've seen products go into clearing, we've seen the liquidity increase. As you become counterparty indifferent, you actually get different parties coming in and trading that market, and therefore the liquidity actually increases. So you have some products where Marcus is kind of a chicken and egg. Marcus might say there's not enough liquidity for us to clear it, but we might say, well, you know, if you were to clear it, I'm sure there would be enough liquidity that you feel comfortable clearing it. And I think the swap agent creates kind of a natural kind of hybrid, if you like, or incubator, where we could see this kind of standard set, which then incubates it into a place where the liquidity grows and then can be introduced into the full clearing model. So that's something, the products that we would like to see cleared, quite hopeful for.
Okay, and try, so there are going to be some products that it's just going to be too difficult to clear?
Yeah, you know, I agree with that. You know, I think, you know, when you clear the product, it's also at the liquidity, like, you know, like what Stuart mentioned, but I also agree with Mark, there will be product that would never be clear, right? You know, there's not enough liquidity in the market, you know, there's not enough transparency for the market data, consensus for the pricing models and risk and margin and so on. So it becomes difficult. However, I think we would have, you know, we have seen more and more product have been cleared. We talk about quad currency swap, markets talk about FX option that, you know, LCH and a few other are looking at. You know, Eurek announced a few months ago about, you know, clearing delivery FX, you know, FX forward, FX swap. So I think there will be more and more product going to be clear, but there's a certain limit, you know, where it doesn't make sense to put, you know, some of that exotic into that. And mainly because of economic or because of challenges to, you know, price and risk manage those products.
Okay, does anyone else have anything to add on that? Or?
I'd just say from a regulatory perspective, you know, again, going back to the points that I've made before around the fact that in a world where CCPs are becoming much more systemically important, we don't want products in the CCP that can't be cleared. So some of the preconditions that people have talked about here around kind of robust valuation methodologies, sufficient liquidity, enough transactional activity, enough standardization, they're the types of preconditions that we would be expecting to see. And I think if CCPs were coming to present products to us, and that would be either us directly or through the colleges that we kind of sit on, you know, they're the types of things that we're evaluating to make sure, and I guess that's what we're also expecting the CCP to be doing, to make sure that they can actually risk manage them ahead of accepting those.
Okay. Nick, did you have anything on that? Okay. So just related to that, there's another question from the floor, specifically directed at Sarah and Marcus, but with the increased focus on collateral optimization, will centrally cleared repos come back on the agenda? Who wants to take that first?
I can only answer that question kind of in terms of our experience. So we do clear repos, but we clear the repo market in Europe, and effectively the repo market is effectively a cleared market in Europe, and it's been cleared for some time. The benefits of that have really come about because of counterparty kind of counterparty risk, as well as it's also introduced a degree of anonymous trading capabilities as well. I can't really comment in terms of that, the applicability of a similar model here in Australia. I think a lot depends on the size of the market. There has to be, again, from a CCP's perspective, sufficient liquidity and participants for any products to be cleared. And I can't comment on the size of the Australian market, but I think the markets certainly in Europe, which are pretty liquid and pretty large, we have a pretty active repo market there.
And Sarah, is this something that you've been giving much thought to?
Well, there was a lot of work that's already gone on looking at whether there should be a central counterparty for repo in the Australian market, and it concluded that there wasn't the case for that. So, you know, we certainly haven't looked to revisit that conclusion at this stage.
Okay. Good. And there's about sort of 5 or 10 minutes left for the discussion. So I wanted to also get some thoughts on technology and the role that sort of technology can play in the clear derivatives space. You know, particularly things like distributed ledger technology and how that might feed into the world of derivatives and the support that it can provide clearing houses and any thoughts on that. So I don't know Nick, do you want to start on that?
Yeah, the big topic, easy to go on to a million tangents. So I'll go on the first thing and frame my thoughts on distributed ledger technology. You've got to think about what you're trying to solve. It's not that there aren't problems to solve, but a lot of people flick straight to speed of settlement and whatnot. And again, on prior panels about, you know, collateral demands and settlement and whatnot, there's a very good reason why some trades are T plus plenty, or because the people want to actually use that netting capability, having a trade settle the minute you've done it. Specifically for someone like Stuart, it might be an absolute nightmare if he's trying to get set in a position through a day and he's getting these trades are settling. It might create a huge collateral burden which might be created. And another situation, maybe Brexit last year in Marx's world, the amount of transactions that would have occurred and the amount of both trades and collateral that got moved around was huge. So is there a problem in settlement? No. And if there was a situation where everything was binary, that this trade is confirmed, it's done, brilliant, it's very autonomous, that's in a situation like Brexit, you can't just say you owe me how many hundreds of millions of pounds of dollars right now, because that has to be a human conversation. So you've got to be careful in how literal you want to take it. So I think there's a lot of room for DLT to help out in removing all those things that we intended to do through consistent regulatory issues such as reporting of trades and creating UTIs and stuff. If humans were actually good at communicating with each other and pre-preparing how we did this throughout the world amongst different countries and regulators, then we wouldn't have a need for it. We would actually all be talking the same language, whether it was on an Excel spreadsheet or through smart contracts. So if you turn that to a distributed ledger technology, then you impose, you must speak the same language, you must give me the same trade details from here as you get from the other side. So it's good, because it's almost the imposition to bring us into the modern era. So that would be a good thing, and it would also save, I'm sure, a lot of cost in reconciliation. So are you changing the world through speed of settlement? No. Do you make things potentially more operationally effective and cost efficient? I'm pretty sure you would. And then you can start, I think it's more that brings the evolution of things through, you know, issuing equity and debt through smart contracts and such like. So you have to think through the next stage. There's no point saying, oh wow, it's the internet or the internet. That didn't mean anything until people started creating things like Skype. So phone calls are now better quality, cheaper, quicker, more reliable. It's that, not just I can do everything. It doesn't mean anything.
Marcus, is this kind of technology going to make your job easier?
I agree with Nick. I think you have to look at it very closely, and technology is generally there to solve a problem that exists rather than the other way around. So I think in the world of derivatives, so will blockchain or DLT really reduce market risk of a 50-year interest rate swap? No, it won't. The market risk will still exist. Will it potentially increase efficiencies and make the process in terms of the managing of collateral and the managing of the margin a lot more efficient? Maybe, but I think it's yet to be determined and yet to be demonstrated. I think that technology can help solve those problems if they are in fact problems. But it will involve, I think, an overall change in market structure. I think you can't just change and have this technology in isolation for one specific asset class, whether that be in any form of settlement, because it impacts, can have other knock-on implications in terms of funding as well. And we're not just talking funding locally, but also globally. So I think you've just got to, we've got to look very closely at this technology. And there are certain applications where it can be useful. I think in the cleared world, especially in the derivatives world, which in my world I'm still to be convinced where it can be, where that technology can be applied.
Yeah. And let's get the regulatory perspective for a moment. What is the RBA's stance on innovation and technology?
Yep, so I guess, again, we're technology neutral. It's all around making sure that the way that processes are delivered in clearing and settlement are robust and efficient. And so certainly our standards, our financial stability standards, look at operational risk. We'll look at those types of issues, but technology is basically underpinning that. Certainly in the DLT space, we've not seen anything revolutionary in the financial services world. A lot of it is kind of private DLT, centralized operators setting governance processes, control access, etc. So again, in the clearing and settlement space, it probably doesn't look a lot different to what it does today, but perhaps there are some efficiencies around reconciliations and other types of back-end processes.
Stuart.
Oh, sorry, Blake, just one thing, because this is particularly relevant to Sarah's answer in her world. You'd start having DLT as part of the essential basis for clearing and settlement. You just create another systemically important thing. So you've got counterparties, CCPs, and then you've got, you have other reporting entities being systemically important. Now you've got a real core piece of technology which has to be labelled as systemically important and cannot fail.
Sure. Okay. And Stuart, do you have anything to add on the technology side of CLID?
Other than the scratching my head while looking at a Bitcoin chart, I not really my area of expertise.
Sure. Okay. And try.
Yes, I think coming from a technology company, I think I'm a bit more bullish on DLT than one other panelists, but. From where we are, we've done a few experiments using the DLT or blockchain technology. So for example, we did one experiment, including one Australian bank here and another five bank globally at the same time execute a trade, doing matching confirm, through that blockchain technology, almost instantly, right? So in real time. So that's what we did at the bank. But for the clearing world, I think if you see there's still, I don't think we can solve a lot of problems like Marcus said, market risk is still there, right? You still have to do the same thing. But it can certainly improve the operational efficiency, for example. So if you look at right now, a lot of data are duplicated between what the clearing house is using, even the account balance, transaction information, collateral, and so on, between the CCP, the clearing broker, and even to the end client. So a lot of data are duplicated, between different participants. You have to do a lot of reconciliation. A lot of people have to, go and check for that data. So if you have, a same ledger where, all the participants can access in the same, consistent ledger, so that would, for example, would help the efficiency of operation, right, for the clearing operation, for example. So there are areas that we can certainly explore. It's not going to be tomorrow, but I think there are some promise on what we can do to improve the efficiency.
Mark, I just want to go back to you on that. I mean, do you agree, because you were expressing a certain amount of sort of scepticism to the extent to which technology can help. Do you think there are efficiencies, as Troy was saying, to be had there?
I do. I think there are efficiencies, operational efficiencies, to try and make the process as SDP. I think I was more coming from a will it help from a CCP managing market risk perspective? Probably not. But from a longer dated derivatives, I think. But from an operational perspective, yes, there are probably applications. There are ways that the technology can be applied to generate those efficiencies. I think it's the key thing, I think, just to bring up to Nick's point, and I think the point that Sarah mentioned as well, it's important that we don't introduce any additional risks into this process. I think there are already enough risks around with centralized CCPs and with clearing brokers and with the whole infrastructure. I think we just need to make sure that we're not introducing any additional risks by introducing this new technology. It may be quicker, maybe faster, but we need to make sure that it's we're not adding to our already pretty operationally risk intensive infrastructure.
Okay, I think that's quite a good comment with which to leave things on, not to introduce new risks into the system is probably a good message there. Okay, so thank you to our panelists. I'd like to thank Troy, Stuart, Sarah, Marcus and Nick for their very insightful thoughts. Thank you. And with that, I'd like to move on to the next presentation, which is optimising data strategies in a data-driven regulatory compliance era. So James Stewart from Walters Kluwer and Thomas Verlapp from Walters Kluwer Australia will be giving that.